This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Christine, and I'll be reading articles from the Epoch Times, April 24th through 30th, 2024 edition. The first headline is How Big Tech is Consuming America's Electricity and Water, by Kevin Stocklin. As federal net zero policies attempt to shift transportation, heating, and other essentials onto the electric grid, one of the hottest growth sectors of the U.S. economy is poised to increase electricity demand exponentially, further straining an energy infrastructure that is being pushed into the red. Data centers, the so-called brains of the internet, are industrial warehouses packed with rows upon rows of servers. They process, communicate, and store the data behind everything from bank records, online retailers, and social media platforms, to Netflix shows and your personal iPhone videos. Many analysts laud data centers as one of the fastest growing sectors of the real estate market. But the industry may soon find itself hitting a wall as local communities put up increasing resistance to the industry's seemingly insatiable appetite for power and water. The rapid growth of artificial intelligence and other technologies is fueling the demand. Data warehouses consumed 17 gigawatts of electricity in 2022, or about 4% of total U.S. consumption. This is projected to double to 35 gigawatts by 2030. Eric Waddell, who holds a doctorate in information systems and communications and is the founder of tech infrastructure management company Ameris, referred to data centers as energy hogs. Quote, but now your data center for AI applications is no longer a hog. It's an elephant, and it's living in your backyard, he told the Epoch Times. Mr. Waddell has been managing data centers for 25 years, formerly for Vanguard, the world's second largest asset manager. A mere 10 square foot space within the average data center consumes about 10 times as much electricity as the average home, he said. While conventional data centers are already pulling an enormous amount of power, AI computing doesn't use CPUs, but GPU-based systems instead, as the GPUs, graphics processing units, are tailored to better handle complex mathematical functions, he said. But there's a catch. They draw between 5 and 10 times more power than similarly equipped CPU systems. This hefty increase in electricity demand strains a grid that is already predicted to feature power shortages and routine rolling blackouts in the coming years. This is because of the increasing demands being placed on the grid at a time when utilities are aggressively shutting down coal and gas-powered plants in their transition to wind and solar energy. One large regional electric utility, PJM, by Quanta Technologies, forecasts new data center load growth of 7,500 megawatts by 2028, while deactivating 11,100 MW of fossil fuel production megawatts, leaving an 18.6 gigawatt gap between new demand and remaining supply in this sector, according to Mr. Waddell. Quote, 18.6 gigawatts would power roughly 3 million homes or New York City three times over, he said. The ramifications are massive, end quote. Globally, data centers consume about 3% of the world's electricity, according to Ryan Yonk, an economist at the American Institute for Economic Research. This consumption tends to be steady and predictable, and utilities can expand to accommodate it, he said. However, problems arise when centers become concentrated in a single area, especially if that area is transitioning away from fossil fuels. Quote, for individual communities, there are some real questions about data centers going in, particularly if they are going to be clustered, and they often are, Mr. Yonk told the Epoch Times. Data centers end up having consistent power requirements, which means that the grid can be pretty well expanded as long as production capacity is high enough. But as we transition more to renewables, the greater the baseline demand, the more problematic it can be. For anyone who conducts a Google search or makes an Amazon purchase, that transaction will likely be processed in what is known as Data Center Alley, home to about 150 data warehouses in Loudoun County, Virginia. Data Center Alley had its beginnings in the 1980s when America Online located its headquarters there. It quickly drew in others because of its proximity to Washington, its construction of the world's densest fiber optic network, a supply of relatively cheap electricity, and local tax incentives. Quote, this is the area where you want to locate to connect up to everything else. Julie Bolthouse, Director of Land Use at the Piedmont Environmental Council, told the Epoch Times. Quote, what's happened from the 90s to now is that we've supersized them. We've gone from a small building that was part of a larger business campus and was only 5 megawatts to these hyperscale warehouse type buildings that are now 200,000 square feet, and they're using up to 90 megawatts per building. For scale, 90 megawatts is about the electricity consumption of 22,000 homes, according to a PEC report. The data center network in Northern Virginia expanded in 2022 to include a development called the Digital Gateway, a cluster roughly equal in size to Data Center Alley, located in nearby Prince William County, Virginia. This new development includes 37 buildings and 14 substations at 200,000 square feet each, Ms. Bolthouse said, and more developments are in the pipeline throughout the area. The current and incoming data centers combined would increase electricity usage by more than 20 gigawatts, the PEC states in the report. Currently, the total peak demand for that area is 23 gigawatts, so Northern Virginia data centers would almost double the local electricity demand, using about as much as 5.5 million homes. The problem for local communities is that once a municipality approves the development, the electric utility must build new power generation and transmission lines to service that development. The cost of this new infrastructure is largely borne by the community in the form of higher electric bills for all ratepayers. Quote, when we pay our electric bills each month, you're giving a huge subsidy to multi-billion dollar companies like Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and Apple, the PEC report reads. As a result, data centers are increasingly facing local resistance when they try to build new facilities. Consequently, developers have started looking elsewhere in search of land, cheap energy, and abundant groundwater. Targeted locations include Atlanta and Columbus, Ohio. Cheyenne, Wyoming has also approved significant data center development. Data center developers are also seeking locations abroad. Quote, I think there will end up being moratoriums, Mr. Waddell said. In Europe and in the UK, they've basically put moratoriums in place on any new data center builds because there's just not enough power. End quote. And the drain on local resources goes beyond electricity to include water usage as well. Data centers concentrate a significant amount of power in a small space, generating more heat than air cooling alone can mitigate. Consequently, they consume enormous amounts of groundwater to keep the servers from overheating. Google, for example, reported that it consumed 5.6 billion gallons of water in 2022, primarily to cool its data centers. This was a 20% increase over what it used in 2021. A 2023 Federal Reserve report states that the data center industry ranked among the 10 largest industries for water consumption in 2021. On top of the electricity used to power the computers, an additional 40% on average is required to cool them, according to Owen Williams, Chief Technical Officer of Subsea Cloud, a manufacturer of underwater data pods. This puts an additional strain on electric grids and consumes enormous volumes of local groundwater in the process. Companies such as Microsoft, Subsea Cloud, and some Chinese competitors believe that they have found a solution. Sink data centers offshore inside deep water pods, thousands of feet below the surface. Submersible data pods may help to reduce the land, electricity, and groundwater required to feed the growing demand from data centers. But ultimately, the global data industry will still need vast amounts of power to fuel its growth, which will continue to strain power grids. End of article. The next article is by Victor Davis Hansen, entitled, Are Iran's Nine Lives Nearing an End? The theocracy of Iran has been the world's arch-embassy attacker over the past half century, so it has zero credibility in crying foul over Israel's April 1st attacks on its consulate in Damascus, Syria, and the killing of Iran's kingpin terrorists of the Revolutionary Guard Corps there. Remember, the world was first introduced to the Iranian Ayatollahs by their violent takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, Iran, in 1980. Iranian surrogates next bombed the U.S. Embassy in Beirut and the Marine Barracks in 1983. In fact, Iran has attacked U.S. and Israeli diplomatic posts off and on for decades, most recently in 2023, when Iran helped plan an attack on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. For this reason and several others, Iran's justification for sending 170 drones, 30 cruise missiles, and 120 ballistic missiles into Israel on the grounds that Israel had bombed an Iranian diplomatic post is completely ridiculous. 1. Iran has never honored diplomatic immunity. Instead, it habitually attacks and kills embassy personnel and blows up diplomatic facilities around the world. 2. On April 1st, the Israelis attacked a pseudo-consulate in Damascus, which was hosting grandees of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as they planned terrorist attacks on Israel. Without Iran, the Middle East might have had a chance to use its enormous oil and natural gas wealth to lift its 500 million people out of poverty, rather than be mired in constant tribal and religious anti-Israeli, anti-American, and anti-Western terrorism. During the Iraq War, Iran's Shiite terrorists and its massive supplies of deadly shaped charged explosive devices killed hundreds of Americans. It routinely hijacks container ships in the Straits of Hormuz and stages near collisions with U.S. ships and planes. How does Iran get away with nonstop anti-Western terrorism, its constant harassment of Persian Gulf maritime traffic, its efforts to subvert Sunni modern regimes, and its serial hostage-taking? The theocrats operate on three general principles. 1. Iran is careful never to attack a major power directly. Until April 13, it had never sent missiles and drones into Israel. Its economy is one-dimensionally dependent on oil exports, and its paranoid government distrusts its own people who have no access to free elections. So, Iranian strategy over the past few decades has relied on surrogates, especially expendable Arab Shiite terrorists in Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen, along with the Sunni Arabs of Hamas, to do its dirty work of killing Israelis and Americans. It loudly egged all of them on and then cowardly denied responsibility once it feared Israeli or U.S. retaliation. 2, it has fooled Western governments and especially left-wing U.S. administrations by posing as a persecuted victim. Iran claims that it is the champion of aggrieved Shiite Arab and Persian minorities unfairly exploited by Israel, moderate Arab regimes, and rich Sunni Gulf monarchies. 3, Iran hopes its pseudo-diplomatic outreach to left-wing Western governments, coupled with its lunatic existential threats and unleashing terrorist attacks on its enemies, can coax or bully the West into granting its concessions, especially time to acquire a dozen or so nuclear weapons. Yet, for all its loud, creepy threats, Iran is incredibly weak and vulnerable. Israel and its allies shot down almost all its recent nocturnal missile and drone barrages. A lot of other missiles reportedly blew up on liftoff in Iran or crashed in transit. Before the Biden appeasement of Iran, the Trump administration had isolated and nearly bankrupt Tehran and its proxies. Its Revolutionary Guard terrorist planners proved to be easy targets once they operated outside Iran. Iran only's hope is to get a bomb, and with it, nuclear deterrence to prevent retaliation when it increases its terrorist surrogate attacks on Israel, the West, and international commerce. Yet now Iran may have jumped the shark by attacking the Israeli homeland for the first time. It is learning that it has almost no sympathetic allies. Does even the Lebanese Hezbollah really want to take revenge against Israel on behalf of Persian Iran, only to see its Shiite neighborhoods in Lebanon reduced to rubble? Do all the pro-Hamas protesters on U.S. campuses and in the streets really want to show Americans that they celebrate Iranian attacks and a potential Iranian war against the United States? Does Iran really believe that 99% of any future Israel barrage against Iranian targets would fall to hit targets in the fashion that its own recent launches failed? Does Iran really believe that its sheer incompetence in attacking Israel warrants them a pardon, as if they should be excused for trying, but not succeeding, to kill thousands of Jews? In sum, Marie, by unleashing a terrorist war in the Middle East and targeting the Israeli homeland, Iran may wake up soon and learn that Israel, the United States, or both might retaliate for a half century of its terrorist aggression, and mostly to the indifference or even the delight of most of the world. End of article. The last story is entitled Get Ready to Be Hammered by Property Taxes by Jeffrey A. Tucker. There have been very few points of financial solace in the past few years, apart from rising financial markets. Part of that has been an incredible increase in home valuations. This comes from inflation, yes, but also from shifts in supply and demand for home purchases. Demand is as it always was, but realizing it is another matter. The problem is on the supply side. In most places around the country, Homes are not going on the market at the same predictable pace they once were. This is because of the soaring cost of new mortgages. Many homeowners purchased their homes when interest rates were absurdly low and negative in real terms, perhaps 2% or 3%. Selling now means paying huge capital gains taxes and then applying for a new mortgage at 7.5%. The implications of that seemingly small change are actually gigantic, and making it work without paying drastically more in monthly bills means moving to a cheaper area of the country or downsizing the quality and size of the home. Rather than make that choice, many homeowners are stuck living right where they are, even if they would prefer some other job or home elsewhere. They are frozen in place, but hey, at least these people have homes that they own, right? Not only that, but the valuation that you see on Zillow is going up and up. Yay. Not so fast. In the United States, you pay property taxes on your home. This reality gives rise to the perennial question, do you really own your home? If maintaining that title requires paying huge property taxes on the place annually, if you don't pay, the house is taken over by the state, period. It feels a bit like renting, doesn't it? Indeed, the difference between renting and owning can get a bit blurry. Property taxes are the way schools are funded in the United States, generally speaking, and with some exceptions. Taxes are organized according to school districts, the lines of which are extremely strict. An identical home one street from the next can have a big price difference based entirely on market perceptions of the quality of the schools in the relevant district. This is a major reason why school choice, whereby anyone from any district can attend any other, has never made much progress politically in the United States. It means a tremendous scrambling of ownership valuations. No one wants that. You pay these taxes whether you use the schools or not, and whether or not you even have children at all. That's what makes them public schools. The public shares in the expense. But the reality is that it is not the public, but just property owners from one district to another, with subsidies added by state governments and the federal government plus booster organizations formed by parents. If you are living in a district and stuck in a home because of the costs, if you were to move, you are still stuck paying taxes regardless. These are assessed annually based not on the price at which you purchased the home, but on the value of the home at present market value. That doesn't seem fair either. Why should you continue to have to pay more and more in taxes based on a valuation that you are not actually seeing in any kind of profit? You are a sitting duck, forced to cough up whatever the assessors and tax collectors decide you have to pay. This year alone, we are seeing huge increases in market valuations that are reflected in taxes that you have to pay whether you use public schools or not. The taxes on many mid-sized homes in Texas, for example, are going up by thousands of dollars right now. The fear in Georgia is so large that some activists have put on the ballot an initiative to cap property taxes to insulate them from market pressures. Adding to the frustration here is the terrible reality of school closures during 2020 through 2022. Even if you wanted to use the schools, you could not because authorities said there were viruses in the schools that the children would spread and bring home. There is never any evidence of all that. Schools were uniquely guilty of viral spread, but their perception was used as the excuse to force everyone into Zoom school, which taught the kids nothing. We are now faced with years of learning loss that keep getting worse, not to mention soaring absenteeism. The routines of an entire generation are disrupted and not returned to normal. In this period, parents were forced to learn to homeschool their kids or pay for private schools. There was never any effort to refund the taxes that people were paying for services they did not use. The taxes had to be paid for schools that were closed and refused to teach the kids in person. That doesn't seem fair either, does it? After the schools opened back up, millions of parents decided to stick with homeschooling and private schooling, especially after the nationwide revelations about what the kids were actually being taught in the classroom. As lockdowns and the chaos of school closures drove a generation of kids to TikTok and Instagram, they learned all about the ability to magically change one's gender identity on command by dressing up in a different way. Government authorities and cultural elites all said this was great and wonderful. Parents have been heartbroken and alarmed as their own children suddenly announce the desire to hack off body parts, while school authorities call this gender-affirming care. The gains of this movement further prompted the exodus from public schooling. Still, nothing changed about the financing of these institutions. Property taxes still had to be paid. Now they are going sky high thanks to limited supply and times of high mortgage rates. The tax machinery just keeps operating regardless of the circumstances. And now families with declining standards of living, thanks to inflation, are being presented with intolerable bills. If you are getting the sense of a candle burning at both ends, you are right. We have bad schools that are funded by property taxes that are going to the moon even as inflation is raging and eating away at household finances, as millions of parents have sought out other means by which their kids can be educated. This whole situation is completely unsustainable. We need dramatic reforms of financing systems, tax systems, and school structures in order to not drive the public into absolute fits of revolt. That is not likely because political systems no longer work to reflect the public interest. So we just keep trucking on while pretending that all this will work out in the end. End of article and end of my reading. This has been Christine reading from the Epic Times, and I hope you have a wonderful day.